It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Iraqi Kurdish forces say they have retaken 5 villages east of the Islamic State-held city of Mosul in an operation launched early Sunday. Kurdish Brigadier General Dedawan Hershid Tofik described the operation outside Mosul as ongoing. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells VOA such a push by the Kurdish fighters was expected and that these current attacks might be probe attacks with a major push next month or in October.
Most important thing to remember is what are the political forces or political events which are going to go along with this military action in order to get to control Mosul and to kick out the ISIS.
Mosul is where Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared a caliphate in 2014, covering Iraq and Syria, along with other parts of the regions in the Middle East. A U.S.-backed coalition of Syrian fighters, fresh from driving Islamic State extremists from the key northern city of Manbij, says it is now the targeting an IS-held town, Al-Bab, that is also near the Turkish border. By capturing Al-Bab, the Syrian Democratic Forces would tighten their grip on the area along the border, making it more difficult for the Islamic State to infiltrate fighters and supplies. Nigeria's government says it's reaching out to Boko Haram after a new video surfaced online Sunday showing as many as 50 of the Chibok schoolgirls kidnapped in 2014. The militant group says several girls have died and they are demanding a prisoner swap for the rest. This is VOA News. Zambian President Edgar Lungu maintains a slim lead with nearly half the votes counted from last week's national election over chief rival Hakainde Hichilema of the opposition United Party for National Development. Mr. Lungu led by some 25,000 votes out of 1.3 million cast. The winner must receive more than 50% of the vote to avoid a second runoff. Hichilema criticized the National Election Commission for the low pace in releasing results. Zambia's weak economy is seen as the key issue. A Muslim cleric and his associate have been shot and killed in New York by a gunman who is still at large. Incident took place outside a mosque in the Ozone Park section of Queens. A motive for that shooting not immediately known. Debbie Al-Montazer is board president of the Muslim Community Network.
I am deeply saddened to say that a lot of what's behind this crime and other hate crimes that have happened to American Muslims is the anti-Muslim rhetoric that continues day in and day out within the media. And at the hands of presidential candidates who are basically using anti-Muslim rhetoric for their own political gains.
Members of the Bangladeshi community who attend the mosque where the shooting happened say they want it treated as a hate crime. The mayor of the U.S. city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Tom Barrett, says the National Guard is being activated and will be deployed if trouble breaks out after another fatal shooting of an African-American man.
The National Guard will be activated, but it will not be deployed unless Chief Flynn decides to deploy it. 125 members of the National Guard are on their way to Milwaukee as we speak.
Violence in the Midwestern city left 6 stores burned, police cars destroyed, and a teenage girl wounded by gunfire. Several officers also hurt. Milwaukee shooting is the latest in a series of incidents in which African-American men died as a result of police action, which sparked violence and protest. Now what's going on at the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro? Fastest man in the world, they call him, has won the unprecedented third straight gold medal in the men's 100-meter dash. He is Jamaica's Usain Bolt. How about that? Canada's Andre de Grasse took the bronze. Justin Gatlin of the United States took silver. You can get all the latest on what's happening at the Rio Games at our website, which is voanews.com. And don't forget about the ever-available VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington, filling in for James Butte, who will return from vacation tomorrow. Today is Monday, August 15th, and here are some of the stories that we're covering.
The Electoral Commission of Zambia has been recognized in the past as conducting credible elections.
That's Sylvie Kinigi, leader of the Carter Center Poll Monitoring Group for Zambia's elections. She's urging transparency in processing the results. Malawi human rights activist Timothy Mtambo is critical of a new law that he says could limit public access to government information.
This practice will even go against the principles of good governance, which is transparency and accountability. It's like you are prolonging the process, you are making it difficult for the citizens to access information.
And experts work to help wildlife coexist with the humans who encroach on their habitats. Also, a look at some who profit from road chaos in South Africa. All that and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Carter Center Poll Observer Team monitoring the Zambian elections has called on citizens to remain calm. This as the Electoral Commission releases the results of the polls. Anxiety remains reportedly high because the Electoral Commission slowly certifies the results of the presidential election. Sylvie Kinigi is a former Prime Minister of Burundi and leader of the Carter Center Poll Monitoring Group. She told reporter Peter Cloti her group encouraged the Electoral Commission to be more transparent in its processes.
The Electoral Commission of Zambia has been recognized in the past as conducting credible elections. And the Carter Center welcomes and encourages the new positive steps taken by the Election Commission. During the meeting, we asked them to improve its credibility to all key electoral stakeholders by increasing transparency about its processes. But the release of results was extremely slow and fast on announcement schedule. And given the apparent slowness in the counting and verification process, it can affect the credibility of the ITVET.
Interacting with the officials of the Electoral Commission, did they say when the final presidential results will be declared?
By the moment, the results are coming slowly. And the observers have been at Mulungushi for the announcement of the results. And by now, over 80 constituencies have been already reported. And we hope that they will be try to be more fast and to be able to give the result as soon as possible, maybe today by night or tomorrow by the morning. What we recommend for that issue is that really the ECZ try to be efficient and expeditious as possible and try to make sure that the results are accurately reported. Because all the stakeholders, the leader of the parties, the civil society, even the local observer, really are now anxious to receive such results.
Did the Electoral Commission explain why there's so much delay in releasing the results, particularly of the presidential election?
No explanation is given. They show that they are working. They show that they are trying to give slowly the results by constituency. And if you watch to the television, as I told you, the political parties are observing in Mulungu Center. And the stakeholders, the civil society are there. So we think that they are doing their own activity, but really it is taking time.
The UPND is not happy. Do you think they have legitimate reasons not to be happy about the way the Electoral Commission is releasing the results?
Yeah, if you observe how was the environment during the pre-election campaign, where they have suffered for limited space to access to the media, when they have trying to show the news that they are unhappy. Even now, they are showing that they are unhappy with the counting process.
Sylvie Kinigi is a former Prime Minister of Burundi and leader of the Carter Center Poll Monitoring Group. She spoke with Peter Kloti from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Ivory Coast is headed for a constitutional referendum in October. President Ouattara backs an initiative which would create a Senate and the post of deputy president. But the opposition does not share his enthusiasm. Emily Yob has more from Abidjan.
One of the main reasons to reform the current constitution, Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara has said, is to remove a contentious article on nationality which played a role in years of civil war in a West African nation. Ouattara's political opponent used the article on nationality to block him from several presidential elections in the past, claiming his parents were not born in Ivory Coast and he was thus not eligible. The U.S.-trained economist was elected head of state in 2010 and took office the following year after months of unrest involving supporters of his predecessor as president, Laurent Gbagbo. Ivory Coast has kept his role as the world's leading producer of cocoa despite the civil war earlier in this decade, and Ouattara has since won re-election. He declared one of his main goals is to revise and update the constitution. The text of a new national charter has not yet been released, but when the president announced details of the planned change this month, creating a new post of deputy president and adding a Senate as a second legislative branch of the government, they immediately aroused controversy. The opposition denounced the president's proposal, saying it reflected a lack of national dialogue and consensus. Bamba Morifere is the spokesperson of the CODE, the opposition coalition. When you're bringing a new constitution, all Ivorians should be part of the debate, he says. The president should follow international standards and establish a constitutional commission, Morifere said. It'll take time, as much as needed, but there needs to be an in-depth debate. Ouattara shouldn't try to force his way through. The opposition spokesperson believes Ivory Coast's fragile social order is at stake. Ouattara said he wants the new constitution to establish the office of deputy president, since the office of the president needs to fill such a vacancy. The opposition claims his real agenda is to choose a successor. As for the Senate, he wants to name one-third of the senators, Morifere claims. That's against the separation of powers. Civil society platform Poesie has recently run several small focus groups across the country.
Dans l'ensemble des avis recueillis,
spokesperson Marie-Paul Kodjo says most of those who participated believe the president's new constitution is not what Ivory Coast needs now. They believe priorities are elsewhere, she said, such as action to curb the rising cost of living, unemployment and corruption. Kodjo's group also emphasizes the need for a national consensus on the text of a new constitution and is against creating new institutions that could challenge the nation's existing order. This is necessary given the fragility of the social fabric and the need to rationalize the expenses granted to the governing body, Kodjo said. The civil society organization also asked the government to communicate better on the new text and to publish full details sooner than the minimum period requires before a national referendum, just 2 weeks prior to a vote due to take place in October. Emily Yop for VOA News in Abidjan.
Malawi has introduced a new policy that reduces the number of public servants who can talk on behalf of their government ministries. Authorities say the move is to better coordinate the release of information to the public. But rights campaigners say the reform contradicts the constitutional right to access information. Lamech Messina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
Under the new policy, public servants must sign an oath of secrecy requiring them to stop giving information to members of public. Previously, principal secretaries in various ministries, chief executives of government agencies, as well as district commissioners were allowed to release information of public interest. But under the new regulations, only the government spokesperson and spokespersons of ministries are allowed to release information. But rights campaigners do not agree. Timothy Ntambo is the executive director for a local NGO, Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation.
This practice will even go against the principles of good governance, which is transparency and accountability. You can't say the PS should not be providing the information to the media, yet is the chief administrator of the ministry. It's like you are prolonging the process. You are making it difficult for the citizens to access information.
Ejika Nyongolo is the constitutional lawyer. He told VOA that the exercise contradicts Section 37 of the Constitution of Malawi, which stipulates that every person shall have the right of access to all information held by the state or any of its organs.
It would be possible to argue under the Constitution, if somebody disclosed information in the public interest, they would be protected by the Constitution's guarantee on freedom of expression.
Information Minister Patricia Kariati refused to talk to VOA on the matter, saying it was the responsibility of Minister of Justice to comment. But Justice Minister Samuel Tembenu said the Attorney General Kaleke Nikapale was in a better position to comment because this is an administrative issue. But Kapale said he could not comment because he was too busy. Some commentators say the move is government's attempt to stifle the effectiveness of the new legislation that would allow public access to government information. Tom Kanch is the chairperson of the Media Institute for Southern Africa in Malawi, which is pushing parliament to approve the Access to Information Bill. He hopes the government secrecy laws will be invalidated once the bill is passed into law.
Once the bill comes into place, things like those will become illegal because the bill is aimed at the opening government, improving transparency and accountability, making the government more accessible to the people through information.
However, Information Minister Kariati recently told a local daily, The Nation, that nothing will change in government even if the legislation is passed into law. She said the reform is normal and the only responsible persons will have authority to release information to members of the public and the media. Lamech Messina for VOA News, Blantyre.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington. Today is Monday, August 15th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Ahead on our program, our listener of the day. South Africa has one of the best road networks on the continent, but its highways and streets are exceedingly dangerous. Road safety organizations estimate that between 20,000 and 25,000 people are killed in auto crashes in South Africa every year. Causes include speeding, driving under the influence of alcohol, and incompetent, reckless drivers who acquire their licenses fraudulently from corrupt traffic officials. But some are profiting from the chaos on the roads. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
A car comes in here.
A worker opens a huge metal gate at City Deep Auto. It's one of South Africa's biggest wreck yards in the heart of smoky industrial Johannesburg. Here, in the shadow of a massive mine dump shining white in the sun, a sea of smashed cars flows in rusted rows and piles of jagged steel.
We do Jeep, BMWs, the X3s, X5s, the ML Mercedes, the odd Porsche, the Hiluxes, Isuzus.
Manager Dean Hughes calls the yard a resting place for vehicles that once gleamed in the glory of speed along the highways of several provinces. He says he and his staff members sometimes hear the stories behind some of the wrecks, but mostly they don't really want to know what happened.
You do think about it on the odd occasion, because a lot of people do die. It's almost like a cemetery here, if you think about it.
Everywhere there are mechanics working on cars that have been severely damaged in road accidents.
I'd say 60-70% of them were drunk driving. Why I say that is bottles are left behind. A lot of booze is left behind in the cars.
Sometimes, says Hughes, his workers find small body parts inside wrecks. City Deep Auto makes its money by partially repairing some of the wrecks and selling them. Clusters of men huddle in the yard beneath a radio broadcasting messages to employees. The men talk quietly while carefully examining mangled vehicles. These are the speculators, the gamblers, the potential profiteers, all hoping to cash in on South Africa's road crisis.
They make a decision if it's worth their while to rebuild the car and make some money. Each car is like a business to someone, you know.
Some cars are beyond repair.
Code 4 is a demolished vehicle which you would then probably strip down, throw away. Code 2 is a...
But nothing gets thrown away here. All undamaged or slightly damaged parts are sold, from bumpers to batteries, radiators to roof racks.
You need a door handle, we sell you a door handle. You need an engine, we've got an engine. Hold on 1 second.
A tow truck releases a SUV in the City Deep Auto parking lot. The wreck is metallic gold and brand new, except that its front is torn off. Most of the vehicles here are write-offs delivered by insurance companies. Hughes has worked in the yard for 20 years. He says business has never been better.
If you just take the game itself, people buying cars to rebuild, that's increased dramatically over the years. There are more cars available. There are more scrapyards around, for sure.
Two men in oil-stained blue overalls, skin shining with sweat, drag an axle salvaged from a sedan that once cost its now dead owner more than R500,000. The vehicle is just a block of mangled steel and cracked windows. A stream of dry brown blood runs down a passenger door. City Deep Auto is a stark, disturbing vision of the reality of the tragedy unfolding on South Africa's roads and proof that there's profit in pain and death. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A couple of days ago, the international community celebrated World Elephant Day. Today, Jill Craig talks to experts about the current hot topic in elephant protection called spatial planning, forever encroaching on their habitats. It's not the most glamorous topic, but experts say it's key if we want our great-grandchildren to see iconic African wildlife in anything besides a textbook.
It's not the most exciting topic in the world of conservation, but it could end up being one of the most critical. It's called spatial planning.
By this I mean land can be used for agriculture, land can be used for environment conservation, basically protection and preservation of nature, and not really just conserving it for the sake of it, but for people to be able to use. It can be used for urbanization and human settlement, and it can also be used for industrial development, and these sort of different. It can be used for pastoralism, wildlife ranges, and migratory corridors and stuff like this.
Zachary Maritim is the spatial planning manager at the World Wildlife Fund in Kenya. Kenya's population is expected to double to more than 95 million by 2050. With such rapid growth, it is necessary to plan for the future.
And this process is participatory. You cannot do it as expert-driven, because the constitution now requires that this land use planning processes are done by public participation.
And environmental conservation benefits the community, says Titus Musungu, an assistant director of planning for the Kenya Ministry of Lands and Physical Planning. He says people often already understand this connection, but just need some technical assistance. He uses their work in Narok County as an example, home of the famous Masai Mara.
We only try to deepen their actual understanding by using tools such as maps so that they're able to map their own resources. They're able to see the central role that Masai Mara plays, and they can utilize that land sustainably by sharing it with the animals and being able to still utilize it for their own purposes, and at the same time being able to attract touristic investment.
The WWF says Kenyan wildlife authorities shoot between 50 and 120 problem elephants per year. The most common problem is elephants trampling or eating crops. Through collaborative planning and other initiatives, many are hoping to reduce this conflict in the future. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Official corruption and bribery are well-known themes in most of Africa, and there have been various strategies to deal with it, both on the continent and by NGOs. But as VOA's Adam Phillips reports, corruption is nothing new in American politics either, although the scope and definitions of corruption have changed over time.
One of the biggest American corruption stories in recent years occurred in 2011 when Illinois State Governor Rod Blagojevich was convicted of 17 corruption charges, including conspiring to sell the U.S. Senate seat vacated by President-elect Barack Obama in 2008. American life offers many colorful examples of political corruption. But according to Columbia University political science professor Justin Phillips, Blagojevich's crimes were especially brazen.
Corruption in American politics has typically been trading of government contracts or government benefits for oftentimes just simply campaign contributions. Or I take you to a basketball game, give you some great seats, and in exchange, you know, you get something that my client wants.
If the exchange of goods and services for money is legitimate in the public marketplace, why is it considered immoral in politics? Kent Redfield, a political science professor at the University of Illinois and the author of several books on state politics and corruption, says politicians are elected or appointed to do the people's business, not their own.
If they are benefiting personally from bribes, extortion, campaign finance contributions, then they essentially have a conflict of interest. This distorts public policy. That's really what's wrong with it, is that if citizens ultimately believe that everything's for sale and it's corrupt, then they have no reason to support the political system.
Redfield describes Illinois Governor Blagojevich's pay-for-play politics as a modern-day continuation of the so-called machine-style politics that were the norm in big cities like Chicago and New York from the mid-19th century until the 1960s. Machine politicians relied on new immigrants who had little political pull. In exchange for votes, party bosses would give the newcomers jobs once their candidates were put in office, or politicians would take bribes for ensuring the efficient delivery of city services like snow or garbage removal, or the granting of lucrative city contracts.
I guess in a perverse way, that does mean that if you've got enough resources, you can kind of ensure that things are going to get done unless somebody outbids you. But on the other hand, you know, it only works for people that have resources, and that generates discontent, and those are the sorts of things that historically lead to political upheaval and revolution.
Ultimately, however, Phillips says that legal reforms broke the power of the party machine. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
That's it for this Monday, August 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm William Eagle in Washington, wishing you'll have a peaceful Monday.
Next on Let's Talk, obsession in a relationship. What does it do? Help or hurt the relationship? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing obsession in a relationship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.